Well, Alistair, hello again.
Oh, hello again. Did you hop over from the last episode?
Yeah, I did. I just jumped straight here. What about you?
Oh, I just jumped over as well. I just came through.
Oh, that's so funny. It feels like I was just speaking to you.
Oh, what have you brought with you? Because I've got a cup of tea and a jammy dodger.
Oh my God, I'm so underprepared. I've just brought myself and some vibes. I didn't even bring a glass of water.
You didn't even bring clothes. You're just nude.
Oh, shoot. I'm wearing the hologram clothes again. Silly me.
Oh, Sam.
That's
put
what
them
it is.
On.
Put
You're
them
lucky
on.
This is audio.
Oh, goodness. Well, I mean, unlucky depending on who's listening. So, hi.
Hi. Hey.
That was unnecessary.
Oh, gang, welcome, dear listener, back to our second review of season one of, well, is it our third review? We were having this discussion yesterday. This is our third review of season one. If Church on Ruby Road counts, is this our second episode of season one? Welcome back to our second review of May.
Yeah, exactly. It feels like, well, I know on paper we're talking about episode two of season two, but we feel like it's all together. It's cumulative. This feels very episode three to me. So in my soul, it's episode three of series 14.
Right, right. And if you go like even more purist, we're on like episode number 706 or something at this point.
Of season, oh, what is it like? It's like 37 or something, I think.
Sure. A good jumping on point, season 37.
Yeah, it's a nice soft launch for everyone.
And if you're new here and you've skipped the first episode, A, what are you doing? And B, we thought we'd just say who we are as well. We are a Doctor Who podcast with a fun, fruity and queer twist. If anyone has a better way of describing that, I'd really appreciate it. That's all I could come up with. And we discuss and love all eras of Doctor Who, particularly loving on those from our childhood, discussing our honest highs and lows of all those stories, but generally with quite a positive spin. We always find the joy
we
in
do.
These things.
We manage to get a little giggly.
That's what we say.
And if that sounds like something you like, you can find us on all of the podcast streaming platforms. We're on Apple Music, Spotify, or even on Google Music. I think that's still a thing. And you can find us on all of our social media, all across the universe, at HoolalaPod.
Yeah. Smash that follow button. Smash it. Aggressively.
Do you remember when people used to say, smash that like button and subscribe?
Yo, guys, I'm going to take a second to just remind you to smash that like button. Don't forget to hit subscribe. Like, I don't think that's ever prompted me to subscribe.
No, it would kind of, but you know what it does? You know, don't forget to hit below to subscribe to the Doctor Who YouTube channel.
Don't forget.
That convinces me.
Yes. Don't forget to, yeah, you're so right. Don't forget. That's how
Do
I
Do you
like
remember
it,
the Tom Baker one where he's like, don't forget to subscribe to the Doctor Who YouTube channel? Well, how could I forget that?
You know when people talk about, like, you should have a license to have a podcast? T.
Well, we never passed our test.
We did
guess
not.
What? I'm glad for it, because we are jumping full throttle ahead into reviewing season one, episode two of Doctor Who, The Devil's Chord. Now, this aired a mere few days away for us as a time of recording. It aired on the 11th of May, 2024, in a double bill with the first episode, Space Babies. It had an overnight viewing of 2.4 million, according to the Radio Times, but this is very important. It doesn't include the iPlayer watches. This will come out later. So, I mean, what does it even matter? What do the viewing figures matter?
What does it even matter? I saw Josh Snare's tweet earlier said, quote, the ratings are awful. Literally not our effing problem. We don't work for the BBC or Disney. We're just watching the damn show. If they had one viewer, that one viewer would be me. I'm kicking my feet and giggling. Leave the worry to the production company and chill out, babes. So true. So true.
And the episode currently has an IMDb score of 7 out of 10, which is one more than Space Babies.
Oh, come on. One more. Way.
One more. I thought this episode was a lot of fun. If you haven't seen the episode, it's on iPlayer. It's on Disney Plus if you're international. Not in Northern Ireland, I think. We figured this out a little while ago. Weird little blind spot there, but watch it wherever you can. It is
there
worth
is a
it.
Blind spot. And we've always said wherever that blind spot is, they rely on these episode summaries we do. This is the only version of the story they get if they're non-pirating.
I have such a vivid memory of when I was a kid not seeing the SpongeBob movie in theatres. It would have been, I think, 2002, 2003. And getting the book of the film and reading it cover to cover. And for years, that was the only way I knew what happened in the SpongeBob movie.
How can that possibly translate to the novelization? That is so funny.
It's so funny. I was like, who's David Hasselhoff? So as we said,
how did it describe that whole sequence of his, like, pecs moving together
viscerally
amazing. Was that an awakening for you, maybe?
Oh, no, 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 no.
Oh, no.
SpongeBob himself was.
Oh.
But for anyone who hasn't seen the episode, here is a little recap of the story.
And trust, we're working hard on these stories because there are no plot summaries online yet, which means that we are using 100% of our brain power to come really up with are. These.
You're welcome. You're welcome.
You're welcome.
It's 1925, and composer Timothy Drake teaches his student about the forbidden Devil's Chord, where he unknowingly brings the maestro, played by the incomparable Jinx Monsoon, to life. His student is revealed as Harbinger, the bringer of chaos. Maestro devours the music in Drake's soul, killing him.
In the TARDIS, Ruby and the Doctor head to the swinging 60s after Ruby asks to see the Beatles. After donning their go-go boots, eyeliner and wigs, they head to Abbey Road Studios. However, they soon realise that something is off as they hear the Beatles sing about their not-dead dog, a rusty rendition of Three Blind Mice, and even find Cilla Black singing worse than usual.
Surprise, surprise. All the music is gone from the world, leaving only aeolian tones, sounds of music made without the humans. And in a world without music, the human race are taking an entirely different path. They try to get the Beatles to realise something's wrong, but before they get the chance to truly listen, the Doctor sees Maestro in his teaspoon and drops it, shattering the illusion, and the Beatles remain disgusted by the idea of music.
They are, like, homophobically averse to music, which is so funny. You're disgusted.
It feels really... like, profile, you are disgusting.
You and your ideas, you're disgusting. The Doctor tells Ruby about his granddaughter Susan, and after an impromptu rooftop piano performance from Ruby, despite her not being very good, Maestro is summoned. They arrive with a very familiar giggle, which terrifies the Doctor, and he tells Ruby that they need to hide. They're almost caught until the Doctor uses his sonic to hide them by removing all sound from the area. The trick works, and the Doctor concludes that Maestro must be part of the same pantheon as the Toymaker.
Ruby explains that the world can't end in 1963, because she's allied in the world of, amongst other things, Strictly and tap dancing. The Doctor takes her home and shows the future without music, a nuclear winter with all life destroyed. Maestro is the essence of music, and every song that goes unsung feeds them. They get stronger and stronger, stealing music until the universe stops turning and they've consumed the music of the spheres. Maestro also reveals that a different combination of notes would banish them entirely.
The Doctor takes them back to 1963, where they plan to record the notes of banishment as a weapon. Before they can, Ruby shrieks and is dragged away by the soundtrack itself. Maestro has captured her, the only human left with music in her heart. However, Maestro detects a hidden song deep inside her soul, Carol of the Bells, the music that played on the day she was born.
The Doctor whips out the famous Abbey Road piano for a music battle. He's not a music genius, but he's experienced everything, and if that's where music comes from, then he can find the right notes. He almost manages to find the chord, but eventually hits a dud note. Thankfully, right when all hope seems lost, John Lennon and Paul McCartney appear and kiss. Just kidding, they don't, but they do find the right notes, however. Maestro is banished, but not before warning them that the one who waits is almost here.
Ooh. Before the two go home, the Doctor reminds Ruby that there is always a twist at the end. And with that, we enter a dance number, ending with the two skipping musically across the Abbey Road zebra crossing and back into the TARDIS.
There's always a twist at the end. Now, before we dive into our thoughts on the episode, we reached out to you on our X account at Hula Pod to let us know what you thought, and here are some of your thoughts on the episode.
Jack said, "This was a near perfect watch for me. My only gripe is that I wanted more singing from Jinx because she's just so bloody talented. Absolutely iconic villain already, and again, Shooty Millie glistened together. Very moving at times and exceptionally fun. A new comfort ep."
Chatsunami says, "Thought for the most part it was great, but it was criminal that they never used any Beatles music instead of whatever the outro song was. I don't think they could license it."
Can you imagine if they applied, had the budget, and they said no?
There's always a twist at the end.
Oh, there's always a twist. Dragzilla said, "So much fun and camp as hell. Loved how they just fully threw normal Doctor Who rules out the window. Maestro is an instant classic Doctor Who villain in my book."
Love that. Laura says, "I loved it. Jinx was absolutely incredible. The music battle sequence was one of the best fight scenes in Modern Who, I think, ever." And you know what? Sometimes you need a cheesy musical number to wrap something up.
Saber82 said, "One interesting detail is how they clarified that the Doctor, in a way, has a soul. That is whatever happened during the Bi-Generation. His soul got split in half. And it's interesting how the Doctor says he can't survive that again, which means RTD as a writer has closed that book."
Ethan, friend of the pod, said, "Instantly iconic. I was a little worried about how they'd fit the musical number in, but it felt very earned in the way they did. I love how it examined the value of music to society. The music was iconic. Jinx was just fabulous. 8 out of 10 for me."
Alexander said, I reasonably enjoyed it. I thought the Maestro, for a relative newcomer, was acted well, and the portrayal of the Beatles decent. I was just put out by the musical routine at the end. It felt like filler.
And finally, Nancy said, "So much fun. Jinx was sensational and genuinely quite scary. We're already seeing so many interesting facets of 15 and Ruby. But, unfortunately, I deeply hated the musical number. Just felt so jarring and cringe to me. I really hope it isn't going to be a reoccurring thing."
If it becomes a reoccurring thing, I will actually just have to learn to accept it. Like,
I think I'm already, in a couple of days, learnt to accept it. And I'm now teaching on the love side of it, so it won't take much for me.
Do you remember when they, like, first teased the Goblin song? And
you,
I was like,
hated it.
I was like, Sam, I'm really worried about this. And then they did the preview in Unleashed, and it was like the worst bit of the song they could have previewed, which was just, "It's a Goblin King, it's a Goblin King."
That's the best bit.
I don't know. Out of context, that one snippet, I was like,
I remember you turning to me at a viewing party and you were like, "I don't think this is going to be good." And I was sat there like, "He's the Goblin King, he's the Goblin King.
It's going to be a long slog for me, this life." That's what I said to
and
you.
And then when we booked Christina, you were like, "Let me listen to it again." You were like, "No, actually, I love it."
Actually, I love it. And I really came around to that. But anyway, we'll talk about the musical number because it is extremely polarizing. Almost like... It's funny, the musical number in itself almost feels like it's approaching like timeless child levels of divisiveness. And it's like, it okay, really here we go again.
Here we go but, again. Like
God, where do we begin? We have so much to say about this episode.
I think we've got to open it talking about Maestro. I think we've got to jump straight in with Jinx Monsoon.
Go on then, let's talk about Maestro. It's an easy high.
It's an easy high for me. I love their introduction. I think that like as soon as they open the piano, I mean, we watched it for the second time at a viewing party, and they just come out like, ta-da, and the hugest like cheer and roar, especially being around queer fans. I love the opening where they steal the soul out of Timothy Drake, and then there's that little bit where they suck on the end of the conducting wand, and they go like... but then they...
I love that.
...turn to the audience and go, right then. And then they start playing the piano, and it goes into dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun. Yes. Oh, that was so good.
Now... On that little bit specifically, controversial, I actually don't like when they remix the theme, which I think is an extremely minority view.
What?
For me, I like the theme is the theme. And when Peter Cavalli plays on electric guitar, or
oh, I love that.
They begin with piano. I know it's...
What about a Christmas with little Christmas bells?
Don't like it. Just leave it alone.
Oh, Alistair.
So that is my most miserable take of the episode. I promise I won't go any more miserable than that. So
I think it's going to be your second most miserable take of the episode.
Okay.
If I'm honest.
I don't think it will. I just want to, I'm just saying it now. It's. I know it's, listen, it's not a popular view. You know, what happened to fun? You're not fun. Touch. I know.
Whatever happened to fun?
I know. But I agree so much with what you said about Jinx. My note here is just flawless. Like every line is elevated and for me, like pure Disney villainy and so much campery, like descending from the rooftop and I heard music and the moan swallowing the music from Timothy Drake's heart and Timothy Drake's like leg twitching as he dies. The absolute meltdown on discovering that there's a hidden song in Ruby's heart and just like the stomping and the tantrum and the emotions just being absolutely all over the shop, treating the doctor like he's just absolutely no threat whatsoever. And almost like on reflection, it feels like this character, A, is like one of the best villains we've ever had in Doctor Who, personally, how I feel about it. And a lot of people were saying like almost like straight from the 80s in terms of like just campery, like somehow really marries nicely with like a classic Who villain, despite also feeling very modern. But also feels like arguably it's one of the most Disney elements of the show so far. Like if you imagine Maestro as a classic 2D animated like hand-drawn character in like Renaissance era Disney with exactly the same dialogue and exactly the same costume. It works really well and really strong, I think. Like feels like out of like, you know, like an Ursula type villain.
Yeah. No, I can totally see that. I think that they have such iconic, for both Doctor Who and a Disney project, they have such iconic visual imagery. Do you ever remember, it was made by Arb and I think it was called Angry Kid. It was a stop motion animated face, but on a film body.
No.
And he had hair that looked exactly like Maestro. Anyone who's listened to this, just look up Angry Kid Aardman. And it's very Maestro. Okay, I'm just showing Alistair a picture of Angry Kid.
Oh my God. That is exactly it.
But no, I absolutely adore. I completely agree with everything you said. I think that they're larger than life in the best of ways. I think that it's such a great casting choice to cast Jinx. Personally, I am so happy for Jinx. I know that they've always wanted to perform. I follow them obviously ever since they were first on Drag Race, almost like 10 years ago. And they've always wanted to perform. They always wanted to be an actor. And to see them getting the roles they're having on Broadway and getting this part in Doctor Who, I'm so, so, so proud of them, especially because I know that they've always been interested in pursuing acting with singing. And I think they're such a great voice to have for this, because it's almost like when they sing, it's really coming from their like stomach and the pit of their belly, where it's not like a light singing voice, if you know what I mean. They're bellowing, they're like shouting. Like the scene you said where they're like, I heard music, and they're like shouting.
Yeah, it's like an operatic kind of flair.
Operatic flair. And that scene in particular really reminded me of the Child Catcher from Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. When they're hunting them, it's so, and you can see them get like slowly more and more unhinged in their like their costume and their makeup. It's so good.
You know what? When I was saying about like, oh, where's the kind of really scary villain going to come from? If you and I were still 8 and 9 years old, and there's that kind of like, ooh, something really unsettling about, you know, certain villains and monsters like the Child Catcher.
Yeah.
Jinx is scary in this. Yeah. Descending and going, I heard music, where are you? That absolutely would have been nightmare fuel.
It would have given me the heebie-jeebies, it really. And like you said, when she's like, there's a hidden song within her soul. Like, it's really...
Yeah, it's brilliant, isn't it?
It's nerving. I'm still never going to get used to hearing American people say doctor when she's like, doctor! I was like, ooh, that feels weird.
Jinx talked about the casting and said that Russell T Davies had been to so much of my stuff and always been so supportive. He came to see my show in Manchester. Russell told me that after he saw that show, he was walking home that night and realized he wanted me to play the role that I ended up playing in Doctor Who. And that moment, he started writing the role a little bit more with me in mind. When I got the script, the character's description said, one part the Joker, one part Jinx Monsoon.
Oh, that's so sweet. I'm really, really glad. Because this is the thing, I guess when you're showrunning, you really can just look to people that you admire and be like, I want to work out a way to write a character for you.
Yeah.
It's really, really sweet that like Russell had them in mind.
I really love that. So, yeah, massive high. Like, great villain. Really elevated the story.
Yeah, fantastic. And I think that they really worked well on screen with Shooty and Millie. I know in the last episode that you'll have just listened to, dear listener, we talk a lot about like Ruby and the Doctor's chemistry and how well they work together, but it's just even more heightened in this. The scene at the beginning when they decide they're going to go to the 60s and change their clothes, it's one of the most joyous and like Doctor Who-y scenes I feel like I've enjoyed in so long, personally. When they're running and Ruby's like, I want a beehive, and the Doctor's like, I've got wigs galore. Like, it's just so fun.
I was going to say this under a point about soundtrack generally, because the music that goes with this as well, it's Marlena Shaw's California Soul, and Ruby and the Doctor kind of, they run like giggling like excited kids, like, oh god, I want a beehive, I want eyeliner, I want cocoa boots, I want wigs, and they're both like as excited as each other to just like, they're like holding hands and running in like, oh my god, it's dress up time. And I love the energy. And then like seconds later, camera pans up and the most seamless kind of, what is it, it's not even a cut between the
transition.
Two,
but
just thank you so much for that word, transition.
You're so welcome.
As they step back out of some other doors, and they both kind of like compose themselves, brush themselves off, he kind of like checks his cufflinks. And the number of times I've watched this scene, like honestly just today, this clip, I've probably honestly watched it about 15 times. It's just like, even the choreography of them moving down the stairs, like Millie does this little like skip almost coming down, like she almost like does a little like breaks into a little bit of a jog, you know, and does these little like kicks as she does. And Shooty does a bit of a spin as the Doctor as they come down the stairs, and they both like then kind of step into this kind of like slight swagger as they come out the door. Oh, it's just so good. Like truly like an immaculate scene. And the way like even the camera tilts as that shot progresses as well, like the camera work is beautiful. The TARDIS lights being this beautiful purple, like the costumes themselves, like the reveal of those couldn't have been better. The wig that Shooty's got on as well, like all of it. I was just like, oh my God, like this is so good.
And then when they
like
leave, It's liquid Doctor Who, and when they leave the TARDIS and the music, you hear that it's within the TARDIS, and they close doors and the music kind of stops. But then they're still walking down the Abbey Road crossing, and they're like, like carrying on even out of that. That's exactly like I said, it's liquid Doctor Who. It's a perfect scene for me.
It's a perfect scene. I think in RTD2 so far, I said to you today, I wish I could almost just make a compilation of all my favourite bits, because the highs, I think, have been so high in this era so far. And that would rank as like a top three moment for me. It's so gorgeous. Yeah, 100%.
You know, like after the fact when people make spoiler filled trailers, like for things that people have obviously seen.
Yeah, I would want
one of those where it's all these kinds of scenes, like in a trailer style.
Absolutely. I think, if I may, soundtrack more generally is another high for me that I didn't talk about at all yesterday. How shocking is that? I didn't mention
it. You mentioned it. You were like, I'm going to talk about it, and then never did.
And then I just never did. Murray Gold, my boy. Murray, I love you. Who stars in this
episode?
That's
my boy.
My boy. At long, long, long last. Oh, I'm so glad that he got a cameo in this as well. But anyway, he's been working so hard. In the 60th specials, the soundtrack, obviously we were so excited to have him back, but it felt like he was almost like holding back a little bit. Like it was a bit restrained. We'd get like some callbacks to like Donna's theme or the 10th Doctor's theme or whatever it was, but they were always like very subdued and very subtle. There was a moment with the 11th Doctor's theme, I'm the Doctor, and it was only played for like less than a minute, and it was always very like subtle and like a little almost like lost in the mix. Like it was good, but it was like, you know, often you didn't like,
it was barely there. It was barely there.
Yeah, but it you know, it was still good. But I feel like now I'm like really picking up on like, whoa, that's Murray Gold. And the 15th Doctor's theme specifically for me is starting to eclipse I Am the Doctor as my favorite Doctor's theme.
Ooh.
And there've been a few moments where it kicks in that I'm like, yes. And it's so lively and positive. And I just feel like Murray has just got better and better and better and better. Like I actually don't know how musicians are as gifted as they are to be able to like create sounds like that, you know, like know how to like orchestrate.
I like the pretty noises.
How do you know how all the instruments work? I don't get it.
Yeah, I don't know how they know that they all work together in the way they do to compose instruments to make that sound. I completely agree with you. Like I think that it was very deliberately reserved. I think he wanted to kind of beat the assumption that the 60s just going to be rehashing all of the old stuff. It was very new, but we had this kind of theory at the time. We were saying we think the 60s would be quite subdued, and then the new season was when it was going to go really bombastic and big, and it has. And I've loved it. I've completely loved it. I think it's really smart as well to like in that scene be mixing in actual like 60s music and sort of reintroducing that for a whole new audience as well. And then the way that music is also visually shown in this, like with the music notes dancing around when they're having the music battle. And I know some people might not agree with me on this. I really like the bit where the Doctor is about to try and find the hidden chord to beat Maestro. And it cuts to Ruby and she's hearing this big swelling soundtrack, and then it cuts to the Doctor and it's like very quiet in the background. Ruby's like, can't hear that. And he's like, not really paying attention. And then when she gets snatched away and screams, and the Doctor goes, I thought that was non-diegetic. I think that is so funny. It's so Doctor Who-y to me. I know that not everyone agrees with me.
No,
I think let's get into it. Let's get into it. Let's have a music battle ourselves.
Listen, that line was genius. I will absolutely agree with you. I think the way they visualized music in this episode was awesome. The visuals of like the music notes kind of like flowing out of Jinx, and especially when they like tie up and hoist Ruby up in the air, like surrounded by all the music notes, I was like, whoa, that looks so good. And and I also just think like as a concept, so much fun and so silly that the companion gets dragged off by the soundtrack, by the Murray Gold soundtrack.
I just think that's so good.
That is really funny. You know me, like I'm a real stickler for like, I need to understand the rules. I need to get why what is happening is happening. And so I agree. The line I thought that was non-diegetic is almost like the moment you think of that, it's too good to not include. Like it had to be in there. Like that concept is so solid about like this soundtrack itself being used against them is so good and so clever. The thing that feels quite seismic in the way that it's, I guess, working within the show, and that I require an in-universe explanation for, is it implies that the Doctor is aware that they're in a show, that there is a soundtrack.
I just don't think it's that deep.
I guess truly. This is it,
I've seen
right?
a lot of people talking about that online, but I just don't think, I think it's a one-off joke for that moment.
Maybe so. I think I need to know, is it a plot point or not? Because this combined with, and we'll get to it, the somewhat unexplained kind of music video ending. How is it running indoors? How are Shirley Ballas and Johannes there? I don't know. I don't know how that's possible. You know, did the zebra crossing light up when they danced on it, or was that imagined? Like, I guess I kind of just, I have an itch to know, like, what happened.
You just
there.
Have to have things spelled out for you. You don't have an imagination. You wow. can't piece together yourself. It's okay, darling. Don't well, worry, it's alright.
I heard.
No, I'm kidding.
That. You're so mean. I heard that the explanation for some of this is that it was meant to be in the script, or it maybe is buried in the script and I've just missed it. And it's meant to be the same rules that apply for the Toymaker's domain. So when the Toymaker is defeated, there's a short window afterwards where magic is still kind of in play. And that allows the Doctor to claim his prize and double the TARDIS with a mallet. Now, because there was some explanation given, I was like, yes, TARDIS with a mallet. That's fun. I like it. But because in this one, there wasn't a reason spelled out, it bothered me. So,
but I guess
if the answer is here, just as simple as saying, we're in Maestro's domain where anything is possible. And it's all very kind of universe bending. And that enables a dance number once Maestro's been defeated. Then I'm kind of like, yeah, okay, and I get that. But I think it was probably the absence of a clear explanation that bothered me.
I guess, yeah, two things I'd say off the back of that. One, as just like a question I guess I'd ask, is I'm curious why it's a bother that something like the non-diegetic line and the Doctor being aware there's music is a difficult thing, like, or like a bother when it's not been explained. And why being able to physically see music isn't as much as a bother when there was no like literal explanation for it. And then the other thing is like, I guess a question for the audience as well, not just for you, is that like, where do we draw the line with us saying, well, I think this is what happened, compared to needing to like be told if you're right or not? Because like you said, that's a completely valid explanation. There's also other theories, which I'm sure we'll get into later, about like, oh, maybe Ruby's involved somehow. Maybe this, maybe that. Like, is there fun to be had, I guess, in going, oh, I think this happened and maybe I'm right. You know what I mean? Like that, I guess, is the whole thing of theories as well.
I mean, the thing is, for the whole of, let's get into this too, the whole of There's Always a Twist.
Okay, let's just dive. There's always a twist at the end.
Because we have to mention the song now.
We have to talk about it.
I feel we're there. So listen, this is controversial. Let me say something controversial. We promised we'd give honest feedback on this, right? And we have two different opinions here. You really, really like this song. For me.
Well, I strongly, I'll get into it.
Oh, sorry. Don't let me put words in your mouth. So for me, I felt that this was actually a low. For me, I'm sorry. I'm really sorry. I know I'm not fun. I'm sorry. Yeah, I get it. I guess I'm not woke.
You win with the gay stuff. That's what you wanted, right? To win.
I feel like we've had a string of musical episodes or musical elements, which have been quite fun up until now, right? Like Spice Up Your Life was a really great sequence with the Toymaker. The Goblin song, I came around to it. I enjoyed it. But for a lot of people, there were massive turn-offs. And this music sequence where it's like suspend disbelief entirely, the Doctor is singing but we can't hear his voice, everyone knows the choreography, everyone's dancing, there's a very literal set of lyrics that kind of reflect the thing the Doctor just said, we've got two people here from Strictly who are dancing in the hallway, it's raining indoors, everyone's got the right umbrellas and you know, I was like, what, like what's happening, like how is this real? And so I think that was what slightly bothered me. And also, dare I say it, I don't like the song. I think had it been maybe a different song where they were all doing like a Beatles number, maybe I would have been like, okay, like it works, because it's, I mean, this is the thing as well, it was visually gorgeous as well, like it was so stunning. And seeing the behind the scenes as well, because Millie Gibson puts something on her story, and you could see like how the set was built and how they like poured in water through the ceiling and everyone kind of running off set with their little umbrellas. And I was like, oh, that's so lovely. But it's a catchy song. But for me, it's giving "We Have Agatha All Along at Home."
That's such a random way of thinking about it. I see.
It was very like, oh, we should do a catchy number because that like charted Agatha All Along, and like maybe we should do that.
Yeah, I see that. For me, I have a different opinion from you, but not the one you're expecting. Okay. I have both love and fairly strong dislike for it. On first viewing, absolutely hated it. Like when I immediately saw it, I was like, oh God, what the hell was that? That was so weird. And I had the exact same concerns as you. I was like, I want like an in-universe explanation. Why is this happening? Why isn't this happening? Blah, 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 blah. I watched it a few more times after that, and I've actually found like a lot of joy in it. And I think that it's fine to just be like in this moment, as in having just watched episode 2 of a series that's not done yet, for me anyway, to go, that was fun. That was silly. I hope it gets explained later on. I can foresee it might not get an explanation. Yeah. There are actually some interesting theories with the Strictly thing that you mentioned that I think we'll get into in a bit. And I can see two outcomes. I can see an outcome where there is no explanation. That was it. We've all got to go over it. And I can see us getting to the finale and being like, oh, that's why they did that. That's really interesting. However, on the topic you were saying of the actual quality of the song, I'm with you on the fact. I think it's catchy and I like it. And you best believe I've been walking around singing the chorus. There's always a twist. There's always a twist. I actually think the chorus is fun, but the lyrics themselves of the verses are so bad that they are equally as bad to me as the "I've got a dog, he's not dead, my dog." I've written some of the lyrics down. So it's the bits with the Beatles and Cilla.
Okay.
The lyrics are, "There's always a twist at the end. There's always a twist at the end. We ain't no fools from Liverpool, because there's always a twist at the end." So three of the four lines in that verse are just "there's always a twist." And then with Cilla's line, it goes, "I always say that it ends with a twist. That's the only thing that can't be missed. Because we have a little dance, cause we know what's best, because we're the smart girls from the Northwest." And I'm like, those are just as bad lyrics as the other ones were. Like, if this is meant to be the song being like, music's back.
This is like, music's back.
I'm like,
oh my God.
This is
like,
as bad as it was
the
before.
The rich symphony of music. Oh my God. Like, the world is colourful again. And it's like a really irritating song to me. And I was just...
I don't think it's an irritating song, but yeah.
Well, okay. Jury's out.
I don't think it's irritating. I don't think it's great, but I don't think it's irritating. For me.
Yeah, for you. And that's okay. I don't know. Yeah, I was... Yeah, I don't know. So...
How many times have you listened to it outside of the context of watching the episode?
I probably now only heard it three times, but then I also like do feel like, should I have to listen to it five times to learn to like it?
No.
Like at a point that we're like episode 2 of a relaunch of a series where we're like, this is it, guys, new viewers, come aboard, have we got a show for you. I feel like it should slap first time, and I feel like it should also be clear what's happening first time and not be like, well, I hope they explain that in episode 7. I would be immensely satisfied if there was a payoff later in the series where they go, wait, that was really weird. You said Strictly, and then we were doing a dance number. That's all I require, is for someone to go, that's weird. And then it'd be like, did that happen? And just acknowledge it was strange.
Do you want that in the episode, or would you be happy if by the end of the season, the theory that I'm hinting to that we'll get into in a bit happens where they directly say, wait, you said Strictly, and suddenly...
That's what I want later in the series. If that happens,
okay,
I'll look
good.
Back at the scene and say, genius, loved it.
But yeah, I mean, in this world of like, did it happen, did it not? For me, the skipping on Abbey Road was the biggest low, because I come off the back of being like, oh no, I don't mind if it's no explanation. I just think it was like, the episode could have ended, but then come out holding the umbrellas going like, whew, and then episode end. And I feel like that was like one too many things. It felt like, okay, one big suspense of disbelief is fine. Two in a row is a little bit much for me. So I didn't love that. But yeah, that's just my thought on that.
I would say, controversially now, at least it was a continuation of the same sequence with the same song. And why I would say at least is it was a very charming shot.
Oh, it was very
like,
charming,
you know,
yes.
On its own, the two of them having a little skip and dance, the sunset, something hot back in the TARDIS, that was quite a lovely end to kind of high stakes nuclear winter.
Yeah, maybe it's just a case the 45 minutes is quite quick to be doing this kind of episode where no threat, end of the world threat, song and dance. Like, it's quite quick.
It's a lot. It's a whip. Yeah,
it really is.
two other quick lows, and then we'll say some high things. I think we should finish off with some highs, because this wasn't a bad episode.
This is a very good episode.
Yeah, absolutely. Cilla Black. For me, there was a really easy joke missing here, and I see why they didn't want to do it. Because Cilla Black, as they explained in Doctor Who Unleashed, was like the Dua Lipa of the 60s. And they could have just come up to Cilla and she could have been doing like, skin, let's hear it for skin, which is a real song she did. And they could have just gone like, yep, all normal here. Everything's fine. Okay, the one person who, you know, she could just be doing some skin or surprise, surprise. Just in the most like jarring.
I mean, it's probably a licensing thing again.
I know,
though,
but they could have just had her do something so grating and be like.
But I guess also, I also think Russell probably likes Cilla Black.
He probably does. And, or maybe just like if the voice had sounded more like Cilla, I would have enjoyed it more, but it also didn't sound anything like Cilla, and Cilla has quite a distinctive voice.
Maybe. I mean, on that note, I don't think any truly, and I don't mean to be mean, I didn't personally like any of the performances of real people in this, even the Beatles. I feel like they were not necessarily underused, because I think that they were used, if you shouldn't lean on them too much. I think people sometimes expected it was going to be like a Beatles episode, and then when they found out Cilla was going to be in it, like, oh my god, Cilla's going to be in it too. And I'm glad it wasn't all about the Beatles, but I just feel like they would. Someone tweeted, I think it might have been Hamish, before the episode came out, and they said, what if the plot for the episode is that Jinx Monsoon's character has come to the 60s and replaced the Beatles with four guys?
Yes. Which was, again,
like, that's kind of what happened.
Because when the Doctor Who magazine cover came out, and people were like, those don't look like the Beatles. And there were those really mean comments, and one of the Beatles responded on TikTok, and they were like, why am I being told I look like a middle-aged woman? And it would have been really funny if it was like, no, plot point, they're not the Beatles, and that was like part of the story, but no, that wasn't it. And I kind of agree with you. It wasn't a super close resemblance. I guess then my final gripe at the end of this episode is, what happened to 30 years of music that was never made? Because they didn't fight Maestro in 1925. They fought Maestro in 1963 in a world that had no music, or much less music, until then.
Oh,
so there must be all these songs that kind of went unsung that were stolen to gain power, and they weren't, as far as I can tell, put back.
My understanding is that Maestro is a being outside of time, and by defeating them, they kind of undid what they've done.
Right, so they all just, everything popped back.
That was my understanding. Like, in the same way that they went to the future and saw the world without music, and then they defeated them, and I think that the world right now, like Finland, you know, they were saying about, like, was it invading Iceland or something? Like, my understanding of it and the way I read the episode was that by defeating them, they've removed them from time, and time's back on sync.
Got
now.
It. That makes sense. It's somewhat giving Simpsons episode where everything is fine at the end, and by the start of the next episode, no consequences apply. But no, I get it. I do get it.
Bit.
Right, let's say some nice things.
We've got lots of nice things.
The TARDIS really had her moment. Or has been having her moment lately. I feel like the TARDIS has kind of never looked better. Like, whether or not you think, like, this interior is the best interior, the TARDIS generally in her presentation, from the way she flies to the box to the way that the inside is used, I really feel like the TARDIS is so much more interesting than it's been for a bit. The winding staircase really, like, gets its moment, and I feel like they couldn't have done anything more fun with it than what they did today, and I'm excited to see how they keep pushing it, but, I mean, I loved it. When they have to, like, quickly zip back to 1963 using some, like, emergency kind of quick return or something, and then the Doctor's kind of, like, apologizes, oh, God, back to the TARDIS. I really liked that, you know, that kind of, like, affection that's shown as well for the TARDIS, and then when that's done, how the TARDIS, like, slowly boots back on, and the lights start to flicker back on one by one. It's like, and on that as well, my second thing I just wanted to quickly say is that I feel like the sound design in these episodes so far has just been really, really, really strong. So linking to what I was saying about the TARDIS, the grumbly TARDIS noises and the, like, really rapid kind of almost like helicopter spinning sound that we get right before the TARDIS kind of thuds into place when it lands chaotically indoors at the moment, I'm really enjoying that sound. Even the thud landing sound, I'm really enjoying. And in this episode as well, all these other sound effects that just kind of get blended in really nicely with the soundscape, the tuning fork ring, the high-pitched sonic, the use of silence to hide from Maestro. Everything blends in really well. And I just, it's listening to the kind of unreleased soundtracks where they can't quite sponge out all of those noises that I'm being attentive at the minute to, like, oh, there's a lot of really good sound effects in Doctor Who at the minute. Anyway, that was my point.
You love a listen to an unreleased soundtrack, don't you?
My guilty pleasure.
You'll be so, Alice has been sending me YouTube videos recently of just like, here's this bit from the episode, here's this bit, and I'm enjoying listening to them. The bit from Space Babies where the TARDIS flies into the spaceship, I've been listening to that on repeat. That's so good. I agree, both with the TARDIS and the sound design. I think that the quality of this, like, no one can argue that, stories aside, the quality of these episodes, both visually, auditory, it's so, so good. Performance-wise as well, absolutely love it. I really like, talking about performances, just little moments like Ruby and the Doctor walking in and being like, oh, how are they going to let us in? What should we do? And then Ruby seeing the tea lady and being like, oh, I'll grab it. Yeah, Janet, yeah, there's a break. She said he can go. And it's like, there's always a Janet and they always want a copper. And like those little human-y moments, I think they're so fun in Doctor Who. Beg the question, does the psychic paper not exist anymore? Like, where's that? They're not using that to get into places.
It's nice, I guess, if they don't need it, not to use it, because the psychic paper was kind of introduced as like a shortcut to go, I'm a doctor, you can trust me. Yeah. And if they can get around that, it's quite nice.
Yeah, no, I agree. It's nice seeing the doctor have to use like ingenuity without the sonic, and also having the companions have a chance to use their like people skills and know-how to try and get themselves into places. I just think it can lean into really fun moments. Talking about the Doctor and Ruby, one of my real high moments from this episode was the scene on the rooftop, both with Ruby's piano playing and the dialogue about the first Doctor and Susan. Yeah. It really gagged me that this was the first time Susan had ever been mentioned by name in New Who. It's taken nearly 20 years to talk about a quite pivotal companion.
Yeah.
I do think it could be building up to bigger things, which we'll talk about in a little bit. But I really like that scene. I love, they sort of teased it when they released the soundtrack of the Doctor and Ruby's theme, saying Ruby at some point plays on the piano. I thought it was going to be in Church on Ruby Road and it wasn't. So when I saw it in this episode, I was like, oh, they're doing it. Mm-hmm. Yay. The one funny thing about it, though, is like we said in the recap, Ruby being like, that looks like you've got to play music, Ruby. You're the only person with music left in their soul. And she's like, oh, I'm not very good. And then not only does she say, oh, I'm not very good, here's a piece I composed. She then later plays it backwards with the doctor. She literally has her hands behind her back and is playing the piano. And I'm like, girl, what do you mean you're not very good?
She's being modest. She knows she's good. She's being modest.
Girl, that's false modesty.
I really enjoyed that. Actually, her part in the song battle as well, the music battle, was really good. That's a small moment I really enjoyed as well. Them both kind of like playing the keys together, and then they spin around, they keep playing the keys just to keep eye contact. It was really fun.
One shot in the music battle I loved is when Jinx picks up the violin and says like, music battle, but it's, you can tell that it's a shot they filmed in reverse. They would have had to film her talking and then play it backwards, and her like she says it backwards and then throws the violin so she catches it in the shot. It's just so well done. Little clever camera tricks like that really, really work for me.
Yeah, that was fun.
My last point that I want to talk about this episode, which I'm interested to see what they do with it, is continuing from what we were saying in Space Babies, talking about the mystery of Ruby Sunday, because when Maestro has her sort of strung up with the music notes and she's trying to steal her music, she starts singing and Maestro realizes there's a hidden song and something's wrong. And then again, it starts snowing in the auditorium and there's like a song within her soul. And then Maestro goes, well, was he there? He couldn't have been there, was he? The oldest one. And the doctor's like, who is it? Who is it? And then Maestro kind of like wipes him away and releases Ruby. It's really sort of dropping the seeds, not particularly subtly, but it's dropping the seeds for the mystery of Ruby Sunday. And I'm so curious to see what they're going to do with it.
It's nice that we don't have to wait very long to find out. Because is it episode 7 that's the Legend of Ruby Sunday?
The Legend of Ruby Sunday, yeah. Is the last episode called something like The Death of the Doctor or something?
It was called like Empire of Death or something, wasn't it?
Empire of Death. There's death in it. I remember there's death in it. Yeah. But there's right. Legend of Ruby Sunday is episode 7. We're already going to be on episode 3 in a few days.
I know. So it'd be quite nice almost if they resolved some of the mysteries of Ruby Sunday in 7, and then they could almost have a full finale episode after that, which doesn't center around that mystery.
That's interesting.
And a different threat. And it's just the double act working together really well. I wonder.
Yeah.
But we'll see.
We'll see
very soon.
We will see.
Okay, first time in Hoo La La history. Shall we come over to the theory corner?
Come on, it's Clown Town.
No, Sam, it's this way.
Oh, I'm following you. No, I'm following you. I was going over to the clown car. It's over that way. Oh, there's a light. Should I walk towards the light?
Yeah, in here.
Okay, I'm coming. I'm coming to the theory corner.
Hurry up.
Come in. Shut the door. Oh, it's dusty in here, isn't it? Well, anyway.
Turn on the light.
Sweep off those cobwebs. Theories. I've been collating some theories that I've been seeing on the internet. And by collating, I mean filling up your iMessages with them. Theory one, the return of Susan. Mm. So we had a name drop in this episode, the first naming of granddaughter Susan, and an explainer of who Susan is in full, which hasn't happened for quite a long time. And with this as well, we had a few other things that made people think that Susan could be coming back. One, that this is a rebooted series and kind of anything that is explained at this point, we can kind of assume is relevant for the series going forward and relevant to the character of the Doctor, at least. We also see on the rooftop a billboard of Chris Waits and the Carolers, which is a band that actually gets a mention all the way back in the first story in Doctor Who, An Unearthly Child. Also, may I clown?
Go for it.
Carolers. And may I clown Carol of the Bells. And Sam, what is the actor called who played Susan?
It's Caroline Ann Ford.
It's just Carol, babe. Carol.
I'm teasing. It's Carol Ann Ford.
And it's also quite insane that they have cast an actor called Susan Twist. Come on now.
There's always a twist.
There were some theories I saw on Twitter today. People were going full clown mode. I love it. I love it so much. People go this level of insane. And they were like, are we sure that Susan Twist is actually an actor? That there is really an actor called Susan Twist? And this isn't just someone else with a fake IMDb? Because surely there's not a real Susan Twist. Very, very funny. Very funny they cast her in this role. And I almost think, was she even the best for the job or did she just have the best name? I'm sure she's great though. So anyway, I think we can assume this will come to a head in the finale because there is always a twist at the end.
There's always a twist at the end.
And then linked to this, Susan Triad. Who is Susan Triad and who is this mysterious woman we keep seeing in every episode? We see someone, we've seen their face many times and they're always woven in to the stories we see. They almost seem to be either in disguise or maybe they truly believe that they are that person or maybe they really are that person that we see, like Clara Splinters.
Well, I was going to say, I'd heard people saying like, is she just an older Clara Splinter? Because it's that just, kind of thing.
It's the surviving Clara Splinters getting old. So Susan Triad, I think we've seen from the trailers that a Susan will be in the finale. And I think we think that that is Susan Triad. And we know that Triad technology will probably be something that comes up again later in the series. Yes, because Triad, we know from the Giggle, is a technology used by UNIT. Now, Susan Triad, is an anagram for TARDIS. And Susan Twist's character seems to blend in with each time period they appear in like a chameleon. So this is where we go clown hours. At TWW4SC said, what if Susan Triad is just a humanoid TARDIS? They link to the memory TARDIS, and there's an idea that they're using the Doctor's memory to get close. I don't know how that works, but that was the theory. And we do know something's wrong with the TARDIS as well, because we've been hearing the TARDIS make funny noises ever since Wobbly Yonder.
Oh, yeah, that's true, because there's a bit in here where the TARDIS makes a funny noise, and Ruby's like, is that to do with Maestro? And they're just like, no, it's not. That's weird. I do think, I'll say on the back of this one, in the world of Russell T Davies, Torchwood is also an anagram of Doctor Who, and they just did that because it was fun. So I listen, I'm here for Clown Hour. I'm here for fun and fantasy.
Please respect the theory corner that you find yourself
in. I respect
in.
The theory corner. I shall be chiming into theory corner as well. But I do think that might be an interesting nod to the wider world Doctor. I agree that I think there's definitely something wrong with the TARDIS being sort of hinted at, but the fact she's a human TARDIS or a representation of the memory TARDIS, I don't know. I don't know. We'll see.
The one who waits. I think it's quite clear who this is, Sam.
Oh, go on, tell me.
Cherry Sunday.
Ah, must be.
And you know why?
Why?
She didn't get her blasted tea. She didn't get the blasted tea. The other theory is, could the one who waits be Susan? In that she's been waiting for the Doctor to come back, as he promised to do so. One day I shall come back. Yes, I shall come back.
I think people are forgetting, though, that, like, because Susan was obviously in the 60s, but she left in 63 and she got dropped off in, like, wasn't it like 2105 AD or something? Like, it's like Susan got left in the distant future, like after the Dalek invasion of Earth. Like, she's not around anymore.
But we do know that the Doctor never came back for her.
We do.
He did say that today. He never found her again.
We do. In Big Finish, she battled on the Time War.
Well, that's maybe why he thinks she's dead. But could Susan have turned bitter towards her grandfather because he never came back
for
her?
Could have.
More insane theory from someone on Reddit said, could Susan be Ruby Sunday's mum who left her at the church? Or is Ruby even a creation of Susan's to try and bring the Doctor back to Susan through memory?
Dun, dun, dun.
The Pantheon.
Yes.
You'll be familiar with one of the Pantheon, or one of a different Pantheon anyway. In the Sarah Jane Adventures, we know the Doctor meets one of your favourites, the Trickster,
who
belongs to the Pantheon of Discord.
Yes.
You know those memes about, I'm sorry, Angela, but you were meant to die.
Meant? Who said I'm meant to die?
Also very timely, I don't know if you saw this, but Meghan Markle was dressed looking like the Trickster.
Oh God, no, I did see that. I was seeing people tweeting about her and it says they look like they're about to go make a deal with a small
exactly
alien.
And someone's got this picture they've edited in Meghan Markle into Andrea's mirror and captioned it, I need your agreement.
Oh, I love the internet.
Anyway, in this we have Doctor Who's Pantheon. It seems to include godlike beings with powers surpassing the Doctor. Did you notice in this episode what year it was that
I did notice
that Maestro
1925, baby.
Same year that the Toymaker came through. So who else might have come through?
That's too much of a coincidence. Even though they keep going on about coincidences, too much of a coincidence.
So they seem to be immortal. None of these characters have been killed so far, only banished. And we seem to know the Pantheon includes the Toymaker, Maestro, and Maestro's little bitch child.
That is the equivalent. Oh my God. Oh my God. Do you remember in the Sarah Jane Adventures when Rob Madge came out and was like, did I do it properly, sir?
What's this? Time to get my prize. That's what he says.
Time to get my prize. Maybe this is like Rob Madge's little brother.
Please let this be Rob Madge's little brass character.
What if the finale for this is going to be the Pantheon versus the Doctor and it's way bigger than we think and it's the Trickster, the Toymaker, Maestro, Susan. Oh my God, we're going real clan now.
Could it be Susan conducting the whole no, it's too much. Anyway, so what could be happening there? The latest theory about this is that the Pantheon might be the only people who can break the fourth wall and talk to the audience, which would suggest that maybe Ruby's mysterious neighbor, who also broke the fourth wall, never seen a TARDIS before, could also be a member of the Pantheon.
She feels very similar to Susan Twist at this point. Like, I hope that they develop. I mean, I know they will develop her more from things we've seen from filming, but I'm curious to see how they'll make her different from Susan Twist.
Yes, that is a very good point. But, you know, there's another person who breaks the fourth wall, and that's the Doctor. And that might say, is there something here about who the Doctor really is, or where he's really from, or what powers he might have he doesn't even know he has in common with the Pantheon?
Ooh, very interesting.
Last one. Ruby Sunday, who is she, and is she manifesting things around her? Ruby mentioned Star Trek, and suddenly people signing off the space station are dressed like Star Trek characters. She mentioned Strictly, and suddenly we have an all-singing, all-dancing music video with dancers from Strictly. And later, we know she will say, this is so Bridgerton. Just saying.
Mm-hmm.
It's all. I
think that would link very well to why the snow keeps happening and why she made a point of saying, oh, I said snow and suddenly it's snowing. And that scene in Space Babies when she's the only person, it feels like there's very much like an air that people have been saying online that she could be, like, if she's in the Pantheon, she could, look, without even realizing, she could maybe be like, you know, how there's the Toymaker who controls games and Maestro who controls music, and she could, without even realizing, be like the Maestro of stories, and she's the only one who notices, oh, this is, you know, this is exactly like a story, this is a kid's story coming to life. And it could be something like her influence on the computer or something going through time has made them make the story, and her talking about it would definitely, even if this isn't what ends up happening, it would link it all very, very well.
It would link it so nicely together. Yeah, there's been a bunch of theories, exactly like you just said. Some people said we've seen other creatures embodying concepts of games and music. Maybe Ruby embodies the concept of companionship or the concept of memory or the concept of coincidence. Maybe she's another timeless child and the Doctor and her are linked by a shared birth. Maybe they're the same kind. Maybe it's not bestie energy. Maybe it's sibling energy. Maybe they can manifest memories, but only together because they're bonded.
Could be. It definitely seems like memory is something they're leaning towards. I'm going to talk about something that was in an officially released trailer, so I don't feel bad talking about it. If you don't know anything about officially released trailers, don't listen to this. There's a scene in one of the trailers where the Doctor's in the TARDIS screaming, and the TARDIS he's in is clearly his own TARDIS, the current one. Yeah. But then in another release trailer, we know that Disney in their trailers do edit out things that could be potential spoilers. They've done it with lots of the Marvel movies, and it's a different TARDIS interior, and it's actually the TARDIS interior from Tales of the TARDIS. And Russell had said in an interview prior to its release, or post its release, that it was going to link to series one and make more sense once you've watched series one. So it definitely feels like they are linking to the memory TARDIS, and it'll be interesting to see how that connects to the wider story. We also saw Mel in the memory TARDIS as well.
We did.
What's going on?
I know. I'll round it off with this one final insanely clown point. Someone said...
Some of these have parallel. Been clown.
They've all been clown. And it will be none of these, is the answer. we see that scene in Space Babies kind of mirrors the bit with Rose 9 at the end of the world, where he fixes her phone, she calls her mum, calls Jackie. Someone said, what if Rose has something to do with her? And because of the state of the universe with all these celestial beings stepping into reality where anything is now possible, maybe the parallel worlds are more of an open channel and she has a link with Rose.
Listen, I love Rose. I love Billy Piper personally. For me, I don't see that being the case. But hey, I'm excited for people. I just love being back. I mean this, and I'm like teasing. I'm so happy that we're back at a point with Doctor Who where so many people are investing this much time into what could be this. I've seen that. Like, it reminds me of when I used to go on, like, you know, forum Gallifrey. And look at all the filming photos and try and piece it together myself. I just love that Doctor Who's becoming this much of a talking. But I can imagine kids coming back from school the next day and going, oh my God, did you see Doctor Who the weekend? Like, and coming up with all these theories and talking about it. And I'm so happy to feel
like I agree. I so agree. Right. Thank you for sticking with us there. Should we go back into the studio now? Out of the corner. Come on.
Open the door again. Let's get back into the studio because it's time for a fun little game.
A game.
Alistair, are you ready to play Camp or Damn? Now, if anyone who has never listened to a game of Camp or Damn before, and if so, why? We've got so
many
games.
What are you doing?
Go do it.
There's 78 games of Camp or Damp.
Go listen. But we talk about the camp and damp moments from the episode we have just watched. And this has been a corker for them. Alistair, are you ready?
I'm very, very ready, my darling. I'm really ready.
Any and all scenes with Maestro, camp or damp?
No, not camp. I didn't see anything very camp in the performance of James
really?
Monsoon as Sorry. Maestro. No. It was something for the lads.
Something for the lads, yeah. Jinx Mon Lad. The Hoola lads
something
loved it.
Something for Middle
it.
England, man.
The Hoola lads loved it.
The Hoola lads were big fans, yes.
Well, I thought it was pretty camp myself.
It was camp. It was obviously camp. Very, very camp.
Ruby playing the piano backwards after saying she's not very good. We love a humble queen, camp or damp.
No, it is camp. I mean, being like, oh, I'm not very good. Well, all right then. I don't know why it gives the same entry as, well, all right then. All right, I'll play the piano then.
It's her being like, oh, don't make me sing.
Oh, don't make me sing. And then playing the piano backwards. Camp.
Literally. Camp. And finally, controversial one for you, there's always a twist at the end. There's always a twist at the end.
It's undeniably camp. It's especially like, have you seen the version of it on Twitter that's going around? And it's the clean version with no music.
Oh, with no music.
And it's just the squeak of their shoes and like the rattle of the trolley. And it's, that's especially camp. But it does highlight how camp the dancing is.
Yeah, no, I agree. It's undeniably camp. Whether or not you like it in the context of the episode, it is an undeniably camp moment. Well, Asa, I would not leave you high and dry after Camp or Damp. I've got some fun facts for
Please
you
don't.
About this episode.
Okay, go on.
I never would. Well, these actually were collated by friend of the pod, Josh, so I'll thank Josh for these. There's some really good fun facts in here that I kind of wanted to be surprised myself, so I asked him to get some fun facts for this episode, and he's got some treats. There's always a twist at the end contains the same scream as the Goblin Song throughout. So the beginning of Goblin Song where it goes, like that
was a good impression of it.
Throughout. Thank you.
That was less good.
And it does make me wonder if you want to lean into all the theories about whether or not it's like Ruby heard the goblins sing, which is explained within the episode. It's now in her head. She's like, oh, this is what happens in these adventures. And if she is controlling time, maybe that's influencing. I don't know.
They're going to be so disappointed.
This was one that he'd actually told me a while ago, and he thought was very important to say to you and the listeners. In 1963, at the time this episode is set, Paul McCartney's fiance was Jane Asher. Now, Jane Asher is the actress who played Andrea Yates in Whatever Happened to Sarah Jane. And I just love that somewhere in the Doctor universe, Jane Asher, at this time, during Maestro, was sitting about how she hates music, probably planning her Poundland Bakewell line.
Planning the Poundland Bakewell line. Oh my God, that's actually hard to say. Planning the Poundland Bakewell line. Is she... She absolutely was. I love that link. Meant? Who says I'm meant to die?
The elderly woman that Maestro kills is played by June Hudson. Now, she played Mrs. Linderhoff in the Class episode for Tonight We Might Die, and also designed costumes, including the iconic scarf for Tom Baker.
I was so happy about this, actually. We did see this with some friends, and she was getting cheers. She's a legendary Classic Who designer. She also designed both of Romana's looks, Romana 1's flowing white dress and Romana 2's schoolgirl.
Yes.
And also apparently Tegan's air steward uniform, among others.
Oh,
and
that's iconic.
Now, I heard this. Now, I could be spreading misinformation, but I heard this on Twitter, so it must be true, that she auditioned for the role. And when it came through, like, she auditioned, she like put herself up for the role.
She didn't tell them like,
she
who
wasn't
she was
approached for it. I imagine someone was like, do you know who this is? And that person probably was Russell T. Davies, but that's what I heard.
That's amazing. Yeah. Oh my God, I'd be so interested if that's true. Now, we are a queer and fruity podcast, so I thought important to include this one. So Ruby in this episode said she wrote a piece of music for her friend Trudy when a girl broke her heart. Now, Trudy is an incredible trans actress called Mary Malone, who featured in The Church on Ruby Road. And Maestro later refers to Trudy and the girls as lesbians. And this is the first time that the word lesbian appears in Doctor Who, 7 years after the first lesbian companion.
I know. It was actually wild that this is the first time it was said.
They've never said the
word lesbian.
And, like,
couldn't be delivered in a better way. Like, heartbroken lesbians. I can't remember exactly how it was said, but it was, like, with that kind of gusto.
I had a moment where I was like, has the word gay ever been said in Doctor Who? And then I remembered
it. You're so gay.
In London, it was like, you're so gay.
Probably is the first time it was said in the new series. Or maybe ever.
It is.
In that context,
maybe,
anyway.
Maybe. Likely ever.
And we've gone so far from gay to lesbians.
Gay. and my final fun fact, which it's pretty obvious for anyone who's deep in Who La La and Who Doctor Who lore, but Maestro plans to ultimately steal the music of the spheres, which is the music created by the universe's motion. Now, this music was first mentioned by the 10th Doctor in the mini episode Made for the Proms, The Music of the Spheres, in 2008.
Scream.
I think it's wild we're getting payoff for an interactive Doctor Who minisode introduced by Freem Regiment at the Proms in 2008. And it's now like a major plot point as to the destruction of the universe.
I genuinely think that's so, so, so funny. Like, that is camp. I mean, maybe the music spheres is like something that exists outside of Who that we didn't know about. Like, it's a known concept.
I'm pretty sure it's just a
reference point.
Doctor Who thing.
But oh my God, I know. I picked it up the second it was said and I was like, Music of the Spheres? I know her.
Now I want to do a minisode on Music of the Spheres for Who La La. To be fair, I've wanted to for a while, but now
Girl,
I really
busy.
Want to.
You can schedule that for some point in 7 weeks' time.
That'll be July. Yeah. That'll be July.
Yeah. Oh, good facts. Well done, Josh. Thanks for those.
Yeah, they're good. Well, thank you as well, dear listener, for listening to a second episode of Who La La today, because we're sure you listened from back to back. Who would have taken a break? Who would have paced them out?
Why would you do that?
Why would you do that?
Why would you do that? Explain
yourself.
No,
seriously, yeah. Why would we do this?
Oi. Oh, why did Wendy this?
As always, we would love you to reach out to us on all of our social media and let you know what you thought of The Devil's Chord. We are everywhere. We are X, the app formerly known as Twitter, Instagram, TikTok, and Threads, all of which are Who La La Pod. And you can also listen to old episodes of the podcast on our YouTube channel at Who La La Pod.
Yes, you can. And you can also support the podcast by rating us 5 stars. It's always appreciated. Follow the pod so you get notifications when we drop new episodes. You can find our coffee, ko-fi. Maybe we'll buy a Dalek one day. Who knows? And then you can share the podcast as well with a friend, with someone else you think might enjoy it, with your audience on Twitter, whether you've got 3 followers or 3 million. Please go ahead and let people know how much you enjoyed our breakdown and how it was just the best Doctor Who podcast you come across in this absolute myriad of Doctor Who podcasts rather right now. And they're all doing a fantastic job, but ours is the best just by a little bit.
Just by a little bit. Like we said, there are millions and millions of Doctor Who podcasts out there. And I keep seeing loads of new ones pop up. It's actually really heartwarming. I keep seeing people interact with who are like fresh new Doctor Who podcasts. And some are unofficial, some are official.
You know
some are good.
You know who's popped up that excited me? You know who did a live reaction lately and they edited it very well with a lot of great visuals? Doctor Who Poop are doing one.
Oh, are they?
I like up to Doctor Who Poop. You're here. Ariana, what are you doing here?
Ariana, what are you doing here? Oh, I'm excited to listen to that. Listen, once we've finished listening to Hoo La La, a Doctor Who podcast, we'll pop over there and listen to theirs as well.
Oh, yes, please. I don't know if it's officially a pod, but I love the girls. I love
you
those
love
girls.
The divas. Well, next week we're excited to talk about episode 3 of season 1 of Doctor Who, Boom, which we will all be watching this Saturday.
I'm actually so bloody excited for this one. I'm ready for hot religious gun wielders.
Me too. And I'm saying it on the pod. Someone said it as a theory. I'm not saying it's going to be true. I don't think it will be true, but I'm saying it on the pod. Will we see Weeping Angels? It's a Stephen Moffat episode with the clerks.
Oh my God. I'm very excited to see Moffat right under RTD again. I think this one's going to be a banger.
Me too.
I've got a really good feeling. Touch wood. I've got a really good feeling about this one.
I've got a very good feeling. I'm very excited. And we are very excited to talk about with you next week. So thank you so much, the listener, for listening as always. And we will see you then.
We'll see you very soon. Have a lovely week.
Bye.
Bye-bye.